WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In an article titled, "A Wrongful Birth?", Elizabeth Weil says recent lawsuits shed an uncomfortable light on contemporary expectations about childbearing and how much control we believe we should have over the babies we give birth to. Her article was published in last Sunday's New York Times Magazine. This is a story that has a personal connection for Weil. The article focuses on a lawsuit. Would you describe the lawsuit that you've written about?
Yes. It was technically a medical malpractice lawsuit. In other states, it might have been called a wrongful birth lawsuit. And it was brought by Anthony and Donna Branca following the birth of their son, AJ. And AJ was born severely disabled, and they did not know this was to be the case prior to his birth. And they felt that the prenatal care that they had received was substandard, and so they sued their doctors.
What are some of the signs they think the obstetrician should have noticed and didn't?
Well, there were several things that were unusual about Donna's pregnancy. She had some bleeding during her first trimester, which was not alarming, but can be an indication of chromosomal defects. And at her midterm sonogram, at about halfway through her pregnancy, when she went in to have her fetus measured and checked for all kinds of things, the fetus appeared smaller than the doctors expected it would have based on when they originally thought she had conceived. And this should also have raised some concerns for further testing. And Donna also never gained much weight. And while none of these things alone would have been a crisis, put together they really should have brought some more testing.
At what point did she find out that her baby had serious problems?
It was shortly before she gave birth. When she was 31 weeks pregnant while she was on vacation with her family, she started having severe bleeding and went to an emergency room. And it was at this point that a doctor finally measured her belly, measured what's called her fundal height. Basically, they just take a tape measure across your swollen tummy to get a rough estimate of how big the fetus is in there. And when the doctor did that, his estimation was this looked like a 24-week-old fetus instead of a 31-week-old fetus, which was rather alarming. And he had major concerns and, in fact, asked Donna if she'd had any prenatal care at all. And this led to a whole series of tests, including a sonogram to confirm that the fetus was abnormally small, and then an amniocentesis, which showed that the baby had both a gene duplication and a gene deletion on the fourth chromosome.
So by the time she found out that her baby was likely to have profound problems, it was too late to have an abortion if she had decided to have one.
Yes. A woman can choose to terminate a pregnancy for whatever reasons up until 24 weeks pregnant, up until she begins her third trimester. So Donna was 31 weeks pregnant, and that was no longer an option.
So what condition was the baby in when he was born?
The baby was born quite small. He weighed 2.5 pounds and was 15 inches long. He didn't cry when he came out, which is always a bad sign. And he had a whole host of problems. He had real difficulty eating. He had seizure disorders. He had difficulty regulating his body temperature. And this, of course, sent the Broncas through endless tests and 17 weeks in the hospital. And the baby was eventually diagnosed with Wolff-Hirschhorn syndrome, which is a very rare condition. But the features of it include seizures and heart problems and a shorter than expected lifespan. And most of the children who have it never learn to speak. Some do eventually learn to walk.
Tell us something about what AJ's life is like now and what condition he's in.
Sure. AJ now lives at the Center for Discovery in New York State. He's 6 years old. He's about the size of a three-year-old. He has 2 3-year-old siblings who are twins. And he has the mental capacity of a 6-month-old. He has a favorite toy. It's a leapfrog infant piano that he plays with all day long. And he spends a lot of time in his wheelchair, although he has very extensive physical therapy. And last summer, he learned how to belly crawl, which was a major achievement for him. And he seems He seems placid. He doesn't seem frustrated as some handicapped children do. But, you know, he has very serious defects.
What are the Broncas asking for in their lawsuit?
The Broncas were asking for compensation for the expense of raising their child. Some states allow parents to sue for emotional damages for having a handicapped child that they did not expect to have. New York is not one of those states, and that is where they live. So they sued for money for AJ's care. And they also told me privately, and this wasn't the legally stated reason why they sued, but they both said to me that they thought they might not have brought the suit at all if Donna's doctors had just apologized to them and said, I'm sorry this happened to you.
You know, at the same time that the Broncas are suing the obstetrician, you say they love AJ deeply.
Yes, and that's part of what's so interesting to me about this issue and about this case. The Broncas clearly love their son. Their love for him is palpable, and it's daily. You know, that AJ's father, Anthony, spent years sleeping in the same room with AJ when he was home, waking up countless times every night to feed him. In fact, he told me a funny story that he was doing everything by the book. You know, if he was supposed to get his medications, one at 2 and one at 3 and one at 4, he would wake up every hour to give them to him. And then when a nurse started coming at night, he realized that the nurse would just sort of cheat and lump them all together. But he had a parent's diligence and also fear, and so was doing everything strictly by the book. So their love for him is not something that they question, although they do really feel that they received substandard prenatal care and that they should have been given the choice about whether to go forward with this pregnancy or not. And because of the care they received, they were deprived of that choice.
So what did they win in the lawsuit?
They won a large settlement that is put away in a trust for AJ, and it's really improved their quality of life. So now, for instance, when AJ comes home, a nurse comes with him. They're also, you know, planning to take a family trip to Disneyland and that will mean bringing a nurse along also, so that they can all have time to enjoy themselves. They have two other young children who need their care also, and I think it means both that they can move forward in some sense, and not just financially, that there was some recompense for what happened to them.
Well, I think it also gets to that if you have a child who is seriously physically and emotionally impaired, then it sure helps if you have the money to pay for care. And, you know,
absolutely.
There's just a really big difference between having to do it all yourself and having some medical help. I mean, the Broncas child is in a home, isn't he?
Yes.
So, I mean, that costs a lot of money.
Yes, it all costs a lot of money. And as they were telling me, even incredibly simple things cost a lot of money. You know, even getting a kind of chair, a tumble form chair that AJ can sit him so he can join them at the dinner table is hundreds of dollars. You know, getting a shower chair so that he can shower at their home is incredibly expensive. That all of these things place a very large burden on families.
What are the larger issues you think this case and similar cases raise?
Raises a lot of very complicated issues for us. The major one is, should we be able to decide to terminate a specific pregnancy, and on what grounds? And by that I mean, these days, a pregnant woman is offered many genetic tests and for all sorts of diseases. And many, many more genetic tests are possible and on the horizon. And which of those tests should be actionable? Should a mother be able to decide that she doesn't want to give birth to a baby who will get a disease like Huntington's later in life? Should a mother decide she doesn't want to give birth to a baby who would be blind? They raise all sorts of issues. You know, right now, the most common reason to terminate a pregnancy for, you know, after a genetic test is for Down syndrome. And there is some comfort level in the country right now with that. But there are many more questions that suits like this raise.
You write that the ethics about selective abortion are being hashed out in the courts through wrongful birth and wrongful life lawsuits. What's the difference between wrongful birth and wrongful life lawsuits?
A wrongful birth lawsuit is brought by the parents against the doctor, saying we feel that we received substandard prenatal care and we wish we had been given the information and the choice to decide to terminate this pregnancy. A wrongful life lawsuit is actually brought by the child claiming, in essence, I wish I hadn't been born. I wish that you had given my parents the information to decide not to bring me into this world. And those lawsuits are much more controversial, and they're also legal in many fewer states.
My guest is Elizabeth Weil. Her article, A Wrongful Birth, was published in last Sunday's New York Times Magazine. We'll hear about her personal connection to the story after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Elizabeth Weil. In last Sunday's New York Times Magazine, she wrote an article about a couple who sued their obstetrician for not having done adequate prenatal testing to determine their fetus was severely handicapped, thereby depriving them of the option of abortion. Now, you have a personal connection to this story that you wrote about. You had a sonogram when you were 5 months pregnant with your second child. What were you told after your 5 month sonogram?
Well, when I went in for a 5 month sonogram, the first thing I was told was that I needed to come back. that I have a very large HMO that is very careful with these things, and I knew when they were doing the sonogram that they were having what I thought was difficulty seeing the fetus's bowels, and so I had actually gone from the sonogram off on a work trip, and when I was in the airport on my way home, I got a message saying, we need you to come back. We're concerned that we see some spots on the bowel. It's called an echogenic bowel, and they're bright white spots that look like there's bone. So I went back, and when I went back in for a follow-up sonogram, this time there appeared to be all sorts of small anomalies. The fetus's liver seemed too big. There seemed to be some spots on the baby's brain. The bowel still did not look right. And this of course, sent my family into a spiral of bad news.
Was there a diagnosis?
There was a diagnosis, but it took several weeks. I was eventually diagnosed with having a CMV, or cytomegalovirus infection, which in and of itself is not harmful and, in fact, incredibly common. Over half of the adults in the United States over 40 have had this virus, and most people never even know they've had it. It's like having the common cold, although some people feel tired or feel like they have mono. It's only dangerous if a woman gets it for the first time when she's pregnant. So I had gotten this virus apparently for the first time when I was pregnant and had passed the virus along to the fetus. And if the virus is passed along to the fetus, then there can be really quite dire effects. We were told that the baby I was carrying would almost certainly be deaf, almost certainly be blind, and probably have very severe mental retardation.
How did you go about deciding? You ended up having an abortion, but how did you go about deciding whether you wanted to do that or not?
It was really an awful process. And part of what was so awful was the uncertainty. What we had was not like having a genetic condition where someone can say for sure, this is what's going on with your fetus, and this is what that baby's quality of life will be like. We were just told that these things were very, very likely, though it was possible we would have a healthy baby. And that was maddening. And so my husband is also a journalist, and being who we are, we both, you know, dove into doing tons and tons of research, you know, assuming that if we researched enough, we would get to really firm ground with it. But we never did. We just kept hearing the same thing. It's very, very likely your baby will be born in this extremely impaired condition. You know, I can't say that there was one moment when it became clear that we were going to terminate the pregnancy. It was just something that I think came to feel like the right thing to both of us slowly, though very painfully.
Did you have any ethical reservations about it?
You know, I fear I'm going to sound like a terrible person, but I didn't. I had lots of fears of feeling endless sadness about the decision, but I didn't feel it was unethical.
And can you talk a little bit about why you didn't think it was unethical?
I guess I very, very much believe that these are decisions to be made by families, and that the fetus I was carrying was not yet a person with the same rights and privileges that I had or my husband had. At that point, we also had a 2-year-old daughter. And I had very big fears about what bringing that baby into the world would mean for the rest of my family.
Although you decided to have an abortion, you've continued to mourn for the baby that you lost.
Yes. Before we found out that the baby had CMV, we found out that he was a boy. And interestingly, that set off, you know, there was a very brief window in which we knew the baby was a boy, but we didn't know he was sick. And it was just a few days. And in those few days, you know, a whole fantasy life of hopes for what this child would be emerged, particularly for my husband. He was just ecstatic in the sonogram room and called his father to talk about, you know, all the great rock climbing adventures they were going to have, you know, all together with this son. And that's been much, much harder to let go of than either of us imagined it would be. You know, I have a daughter who's now 3 and also a baby who's 10 months. And shortly after the baby was born, my older daughter started asking me where babies were before they were born. And so, you know, she said, "Mom, you know, where was I before I was born?" And I was sort of at a loss for words, but I told her she was floating around up in the sky. And then she said, "Well, was Audrey's her baby sister, was Audrey with me?" And I said, "Yeah, Audrey was with you." And, you know, she got this smile that was just sort of, the world all made sense and felt all whole and put together for her. But somehow in telling her that, I had this vision of this boy that we didn't have being with them, which was just heartbreaking to me. And so that baby is really present in our lives in these unexpected ways. And I imagine that baby will stay there for quite a long time.
After you had your abortion, how long did you wait before trying to get pregnant again? And were you afraid to get pregnant again?
Well, we had a few complications, which were unexpected after we had the abortion. But my very strong desire was to get pregnant again right away. I was deeply, deeply upset by the loss of that baby and felt that the only way to get back on my feet was to get pregnant again. And I wound up getting pregnant again about 4 months later.
And were you worried during the pregnancy that after the 5-month sonogram, they'd find what they found before?
Oh, I was terrified. And I found myself not letting myself believe in the pregnancy at all until we'd sort of, you know, gotten a clean bill of health. And I think that's a very common experience for women who've lost pregnancies for all sorts of reasons, including just having a natural miscarriage, if that you don't want to let your heart start hoping for the future you're going to have with that child until you've gotten past the point where you lost the previous pregnancy.
My guest is Elizabeth Weil. Her article, A Wrongful Birth, was published in last Sunday's New York Times Magazine. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Elizabeth Weil. Her article, A Wrongful Birth? Was published in last Sunday's New York Times Magazine. I want to get back to the wrongful birth lawsuits that have been filed. And these are suits that people file against doctors for not having informed them that the baby that the woman was carrying had serious developmental impairments. You write that you think these lawsuits may bias the system toward termination of the pregnancy. Why?
Well, you know, there's a lot of fear of litigation in general, and I spoke with quite a few people about this matter. And there's a fear that the very presence of the tests suggest that these diseases are something you do not want to have. You know, we don't test for things that we all consider to be okay. And so if there is a test for Downs, or there a prenatal test for Downs, or there is a prenatal test for cystic fibrosis, or there is a prenatal test for Fragile X, it suggests that perhaps you don't want to have this baby. And then I think the medical establishment sort of incorporates that, and there are subtle ways, it seems, in which the system tries to shepherd parents towards not having those babies.
The Republican Senator Sam Brownback and Democratic Senator Ted Kennedy have sponsored a bill that relates to what you're talking about. It's called the Prenatally Diagnosed Conditions Awareness Act. Would you explain the intention of this bill?
Yes, the intention of the bill is to give parents more positive information about what living with a disabled child would be like. And there are actually a lot of studies out there that show that raising an impaired child is, on the whole, a lot less different from raising a so-called normal child than a lot of us imagine it will be. And so right now, often when a woman goes in for an amniocentesis to find out, you know, if there are genetic defects with her baby, she's given a very clinical picture of what Down syndrome is and how that is defective. So the intent is to give prospective parents a much more balanced and positive outlook on what it's like to raise disabled children.
You know what I was wondering, among other things, while reading your article, I know that a lot of people strenuously object to the idea of terminating a pregnancy because a sonogram or another test indicated that there would be that the baby would have impairments, serious impairments. At the same time, I think a lot of the babies who are so seriously impaired would never have survived a few years ago before the kind of medical interventions that we have now. I mean,
right.
I mean, for example, the Bronchus baby, AJ, I mean, there was like, what did you say, 17 weeks of major medical interventions
right.
to keep the baby alive. It was born at 2.5 pounds. It had difficulty eating. Seizures and heart trouble are typical problems that come with the condition this baby had. It's I think, probably very unlikely the baby would have survived in an era before abortion. You know, before abortion was medically available, it's unlikely the baby would have been able to survive.
Right. It's very complicated. Yes, these babies are born into, you know, world of NICUs, you know, neonatal intensive care units, and really sophisticated medicine to keep them alive. And you know, generations ago, of course, a lot of these children would have just passed early on in life. So we're at a moment that's very complicated, and it's comparable in many ways to end-of-life issues, where people are being kept alive and others are arguing that perhaps they too should pass on.
Has doing the research for the article that we've been discussing and writing about the Branca family, has it made you think any differently than you thought before about your own decision to have an abortion?
Yes, you know, the research along the way was very painful and also very eye-opening. I spoke to a lot of people in the disability rights field who had a lot of really strong arguments to make. I should say that I didn't come to regret my decision, but the points people made were very challenging to me, and frankly, I think very therapeutic for me to really think about. One issue that came up a lot was the idea of unconditional love for a child, and when does that unconditional love begin, and should we as parents have any right to choose who we enter into those unconditional love relationships with? And I remember sitting at my desk and reading these papers and feeling like a punch to the gut, but also feeling like it was very important for me to go through this and to really, you know, see what we had done clearly and to hear the arguments against it.
If fewer handicapped children are born because more women choose to get the diagnostic tests are getting more precise, and maybe more women choose to have abortions because of the results that they get from those tests, are there concerns about how that will affect the lives of the handicapped children who are born.
Yes, there's a lot of concern that if there are fewer handicapped children, their lives will be more difficult, that there will be fewer resources for them, society will make fewer accommodations, that their handicaps will seem more strange and foreign and more difficult to bear. There have also been some critics on both sides who wonder, what will we think of the parents who have these children? Will we be sort of looking at them sideways and wondering why they decided to bring these handicapped kids into the world?
And maybe punishing them for making the decision. It's like, well, hey, you decided to do this, so, you know, now you take care of it.
Right, that maybe it will be an even greater burden will be placed on families instead of society deciding to take on more of that burden and make the lives of these handicapped kids more comfortable.
Well, Elizabeth Weil, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Elizabeth Weil's article, A Wrongful Birth, was published in last Sunday's New York Times Magazine.